Work session when he gets here. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to open the meeting on the House Energy and Environment Committee for Tuesday, May 19th, 2015. Thank you for being here. We're going to start off today with a public hearing on House Bill 3445. And Beth, can you give us a brief description of the bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3445 would establish a task force on nuclear power consisting of 9 members. We don't have revenue or fiscal impact statements on the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you. And just as a reminder to everyone, this is a hearing because it's such an interesting topic that I think we were all, interested in learning more about, especially what was going on at OSU. But this is not a bill that's eligible to be moved forward from this committee because we are past the deadline, the first chamber deadline for that. So, yes. So with that, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson. Colleagues, distinguished colleagues, I might add, and Chair Vega Peterson, and House committee members and fellow members, I want to thank you for hearing House Bill 3445 today. For the record, my name is State Representative Jim Widener from House District 24, encompassing much of Yamhill County and part of Southwest Washington County. I have served on this committee for multiple sessions, and we have looked for many safe and sustainable fuel solutions. But for the first time since 2009, the topic of nuclear power is having a public hearing. Thank you, Chair Peterson, for allowing this overdue conversation to take place today. Nuclear power has come a long way since 1980, when Oregon passed Measure 7 relating to halting all construction of new power plants. In the meantime, technology has continued to advance at a feverish pace, and the safety, sustainability, and cost-saving advancements have been staggering. In the United States, 64% of the clean power with zero carbon emissions comes from nuclear power. Currently, the United States is number one in sheer number of nuclear reactors. France has adopted their nuclear program, and they now generate 70% of their energy from nuclear power. Much of Western Europe has followed their lead. Nuclear power is safe, carbon neutral, and can easily generate enough power to meet our energy needs. We have one of the leading nuclear engineering programs at Oregon State University, but these world-renowned nuclear engineers must leave Oregon to pursue their careers. These students take their skills and expertise elsewhere, and we here in Oregon lose opportunity to capitalize on their success. Today you will hear from several grad students, undergrad students, and even professor in the Nuclear Engineering Department at Oregon State University, telling us about the amazing work and technical advancements in the nuclear field. Furthermore, we have both Dr. Jose Reyes and Chief Operating Officer Dale Atkinson from NuScale Power, a nuclear power company based in Corvallis and works alongside the Nuclear Engineering Department at OSU. Please keep an open mind to the exciting world of nuclear energy. All this bill would do is establish a task force to study the feasibility of implementation, the cost analysis of implementation, the environmental impact, discuss developing technologies, and recommend a strategy if we, the legislature, chose to implement the findings. The task force would have 2 members from the Senate, 2 from the House, 1 faculty member from Oregon State University Nuclear Engineering Department, 1 member representing the Public Utility Commission, 1 member representing an investor-owned utility company, 1 member representing a consumer-owned utility company, and a final member representing a business involved in the procurement of nuclear energy. These 9 task force members would hold public meetings and encourage community input as we examine the possibilities of nuclear power. If we are truly dedicated to alternative energy, electric automobiles, finding better solutions than coal or wind, and the diminishing the reliance on foreign fossil fuels, then we should have these conversations about new nuclear energy. Lastly, I have to admit, I have another motive for this bill. As a Simpsons fan, I would hope that one day Oregon could get its own Major League Baseball team named the Springfield Isotopes. With that, fellow members, the chair, and Chair Vega Peterson. I will turn it over to the true professionals unless any of you have specific questions for me regarding why I've introduced this bill over and over each session.
Please proceed.
So I'll begin. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'm Jose Reyes. I'm the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of NuScale Power. We're a company that's commercializing a small modular nuclear reactor, and we're developing this in Corvallis. Significant growth in our company and lots of innovation going on, so it's a very exciting time for nuclear. We are up to about 600 people working on our project. We have our main office in Corvallis, and we have our business office in Portland. And I'd say about 300 of those employees are in Oregon. So we've created quite a few jobs here in Oregon because of the work that we're doing. Lots of innovation, about 189 patents that are either pending or granted in 19 countries. So this technology is receiving worldwide interest, and there's good reason for it. I believe it's time now to reconsider nuclear power. So I'm here to support, to testify in favor of House Bill 3445. Times have changed. Back in the 70s, in the later 70s, when I started my career in nuclear, the capacity factors for the national fleet in nuclear is about 50%. So not a very good capacity factor. Today, it's over 90%. So the way in which we maintain, operate nuclear power plants in the fleet has significantly changed. It's become an important part of our clean energy portfolio to such an extent that most recently President Obama's executive order has included for the first time small modular reactors as part of the alternative energy for federal facilities to meet their clean energy goals. So that's a big step forward, and it also says that there's something different about what we're doing with SMRs that hasn't been done in the past. So I'm going to try to explain to you a little bit of that difference. I brought a few slides. I wasn't going to show all these slides, but my thought was a couple of pictures might illustrate the design concept and what's different about what we're doing. So let's see if I can just scroll through real quickly. That's about NuScale.
Okay.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So just to give you sometimes an image, it's just a little bit easier to explain rather than just the text. So this is an image of our module. This is a single module. Just to give you a sense of size, the full height of the central canister there is about 75 feet tall. So that represents the containment. So what you're accustomed to seeing is the large containment dome. So we've eliminated that and gone to a very small, high-strength containment vessel. And inside the containment vessel is the reactor vessel. So it's a very different model for deployment. The reactor vessel it sits inside the containment vessel. We actually pull a vacuum on our containment, so it's like a thermos bottle. And the whole design concept is very simple. It's a reactor vessel inside of basically a steel thermos bottle, underwater, underground. Mm-hmm. That's the whole concept. And it's it's remarkably safe because of that very simple concept that you can use that containment shell as a heat exchanger. And since it's already sitting in a large pool of water, you always have the water that you need to reject heat in the event of any type of an incident. So it's a very simple technology, about 1/20th the size of the large commercial reactors today. We only have 37 fuel assemblies inside the reactor compared to several hundred in the large reactors. So we have a lot less radioactive material to begin with inside these modules. There's no safety-related pumps. No need for emergency generators. And I'll talk more about safety in just a moment, but this is a new level of safety that we're offering. And actually, what I found was that because of the need for having active power at large plants, many people have and communities and in fact folks on the Hill have contacted us and asked us about what's different about these passively safe designs. So by passive safety, what I'm saying is we don't need any active systems, pump systems, to provide the long-term cooling and safety for this design. This just shows one of 12 modules in a single building. The design we are working with to get certified by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a 12-module plant. We have different configurations, but this is the first one that we're moving forward. This is based on customer input. They're looking to retire coal-fired plants, and they're doing them in increments of anywhere between 150 to 300 megawatts to 600 or 500 megawatts electric. So this gives the utilities an opportunity to add modules as modules are needed instead of building a large plant all at once with excess power. It's a natural circulation plant. So hot water is generated in the core. The hot water will rise. The heat's extracted, and the cold water comes back. And you just have a natural circulation system. So there's no internal pumps to this system. Very simple. This is looking at the site. It's about 40 acres for a 600 megawatt electric site that you can build over time. And I won't go through all the details, and I'll save some pictures here. I do want to talk about safety, though. One aspect of our design is that because it has a very small core, in terms of Fukushima type events, this was designed. Specific aspects of our design post-Fukushima. So when we looked at the Fukushima events, we said, what could we do a bit differently here? We found that the one thing we wanted to change was the idea that we don't want to have to rely on DC power to configure our module to put our module in safe configuration. So we're the only design currently that's being offered on the market to make this claim. We call it our triple crown for nuclear safety. The plant can safely shut down, self-cool for an unlimited period of time. There's no 5 days, 7 days, or 10 days that you need to respond to form actions. Basically, it will self-cool for an indefinite period of time with no operator action, no AC or DC power, no additional water. So basically, this transitions from a water-cooled system to an air-cooled system. Without any operator action, and without having to operate any valves in terms of automatic actions and things like that. It doesn't require AC or DC power to do this. The reason is, again, because it's such a small core. As soon as you insert the control rods, within 1 second you're down to about 10 megawatts. Within a day you're about 1 megawatt of heat being generated in your core. That's about the same size as the OSU trigger reactor. And if you didn't do anything at all, it didn't cool water or add water, you just let it continue to heat up and boil off that water, after 30 days you're down to about 400 kilowatts. So it's very, very low power. And after that point, and somewhat before, you can actually cool just by air. There's so much surface area on that containment, we designed it that way, that just air cooling alone is enough to remove all the heat from that core. So we've come up with a it's a game changer, basically, for how you would you handle nuclear safety. So we're very pleased that we can be part of this discussion because of advances in technology like this. Because we've gone simple, we've also become less expensive in terms of capital costs. We're looking at, for the first of a kind, somewhere around $5,000 per kilowatt of installed capacity. So relatively low, and that's for first of a kind. As factories are developed and manufacturing enables mass production of modules, you'll see those prices come down. The fact is that these modules can be installed one at a time. So it's not a construction. You basically build the building, install modules in sequence over time, and that, again, adds flexibility, but it also reduces the cost in how you do these things. Last October, the Utah Associated Municipal Power System announced that they intend to build a NuScale plant, a 12-module NuScale plant in Idaho. So that's exciting for us, and certainly for the company, and certainly for the state, because this is something that's being developed in the state of Oregon, and it's being recognized not just in the U.S. but worldwide as a technology that can truly impact the clean energy portfolios. So we're currently working with UAMPS, and I'll let my colleague Dale talk a little bit more about the UAMPS progress there and their work with Energy Northwest. A novel feature of this design is also that we're looking now at what we call our NuScale Diverse Energy Platform. The idea is that we can actually link these modules to renewable systems. So wind power with the variable output is a challenge once you get above a certain percentage of the grid. What we're finding is that by coupling wind farms to NuScale modules, you can actually add grid stability and level out your power. So this is a major advancement for if you want to increase wind, and you're serious about increasing wind, you need some mechanism other than natural gas, that's a carbon producer, to provide that grid stability and to do it in a clean manner. So we've completed a study with UAMPS, Energy Northwest, which demonstrates that we can effectively couple our NuScale modules to renewables, and that's a big step forward. We have completed four other studies, and we'll be glad to share those with you if you'd like. Those are open and available to the public, which show how we can also use this for desalination. We can also use it for hydrogen production and for other aspects, coal conversion to synthetic fuels. So there are a lot of applications just because of the size of the system, our heat output, and the modularity of the system that allows us to couple to many other applications. So it adds a large, it broadens the market for this product. Let me just summarize very quickly. This NuScale design is not your father's design. This is something new. It's very innovative. It's different. It's based on 40 years of testing and data on in commercial light water reactors. It has a lot of features which people are familiar with, especially the regulator. But it also provides a new level of innovation and safety that we're very proud of. I believe that House Bill 3445 is a major step forward in helping to define a clean and reliable energy future for the state of Oregon. And we stand ready to support you in your efforts. We've submitted some written materials as well as this presentation, and I would be very happy to answer any questions you might have at this time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Reyes.
All right, Chairman Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Dale Atkinson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Nuclear Officer for NuScale Power. I come here with well over 35 years of operating experience, construction, startup, and maintenance of commercial nuclear reactors. I'll let you know that I served on the advisory committee at Oregon State, the Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics programs for many years, and watched this technology develop under Dr. Reyes. Very, very impressed with it, and ultimately made a decision to change my employer to be a part of something that I believe very strongly in. And as Dr. Reyes says, this is not your father's reactor. It's an amazing machine, and I really am very impressed and proud of the work that he's done to get us to this point. I am here to testify in favor of House Bill 3445 for the creation of a task force to study the potential contribution of nuclear power to energy generation in Oregon. I have testified for a similar task force in the state of Washington more than once, and invite you to contact Senator Tim Sheldon in Washington if you want to get some insights on their experience. That committee is still active right now. As mentioned earlier, the nuclear power plants that are in operation today, over 60% of the carbon-free electricity is generated at them. The other sources include hydro, and as we well know in the Northwest, there's not a lot more hydro generation to be created in this country. But we will continue to have growth, and at the same time, utilities face the realities of changing EPA regulations, and as Dr. Reyes stated, are making plans to reduce their reliance on coal. So the electricity generated by coal continues to decline in this nation. Based on information we've received, fully 85% of Americans favor using all clean technologies, including nuclear, to meet future energy needs. We've taken a look at the environmental footprint of the different sources, and we believe that the NuScale small modular reactor compares very, very favorably. As Dr. Reyes stated, a 570-megawatt plant takes about 40 acres. If you put two of them side by side, you know, you've got about 80 acres and over 1,000 megawatts. If you wanted to generate that electricity with wind, you need about 94 square miles. If you want to do it with solar, you need about 17 square miles. So we can do it in a very concentrated location. I'd also like to point out maybe some of the diverse applications. And Jose, if you can go to slide 27. What Dr. Reyes showed or mentioned earlier was this discussion about using the small module reactor, which has a very fast response time for load following, to stabilize the grid for wind power, as you see as one of the paired technologies there in the middle. We have also looked at quite a few other applications, including desalinization, mission-critical facilities. There's a lot of interest in that, providing maybe a microgrid in an area where you want extremely high reliability for electrical power, the use of the technology for conversion or process steam for oil refineries, and even solid fuel like coal to liquid hydrocarbon fuel, and for hydrogen production. I'll offer that our employees, there's a very large number of young employees who are so enthusiastic about what they're bringing to the world to really change both the nuclear, but more importantly, the quality of life and a solution to some really tough problems for the world and for Oregon. I did want to point out, as Jose mentioned, it's a huge leap in technology or in the ideology here that produces a reactor that does not rely on external sources of AC or any sources of AC, DC, operator action, or water that's not already present to protect the health and safety of the public for an indefinite coping period. In support of this, I want to point out that we believe that there's no single technology that can supply all of our power needs. We do think that it's appropriate for states and nations, states and the nation, to look at all of the options. We think that NuScale and the creation of Dr. Reyes and his team have brought a great tool to the toolbox to produce clean electricity and deal with the potential challenges of climate change. I'd like to point out that we believe that the modular application provides a dramatic improvement in our options in the form of safe, modular, scalable, factory-built nuclear reactors. It's conceived right here in Oregon. We do believe there's significant job opportunities, both, as Jose mentioned, in our organization, in the design and licensing, sale and support of these, as well as the manufacturing. I'll also point out that these can be manufactured in the United States and shipped by heavy-haul truck, rail, or barge. We think this is a clean, sustainable future option for abundant power for Oregon. And we'd like to just encourage some discussion on this topic so that it be considered in the portfolio that fits, that Oregonians decide fit their needs moving forward. With that, Madam Chairman, I too am open to questions.
Thank you so much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I know that one of you said the word, said it out loud, but I missed it. What the cost would be, the cost for electric power per whatever, megawatt or kilowatt?
Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Boone, we're looking right now at a first-of-a-kind cost of about $5,000 per kilowatt installed capacity. So for a 12-module plant, that would be just under $3 billion, which is comparable to some coal-fired plants today.
And follow up. So what does that translate into for the power bill to the consumer?
I'll
take that. Chairman Peterson and Representative Boone, essentially we look at the levelized cost of energy over the life cycle of the plant, and our projection right now is at somewhere under $95 per megawatt hour for new construction. That's for our first of a kind. And we've done the math and can tell you that depending on what costs, if any, are assigned for carbon, you're probably looking at a trade-off around that $7.5 to $8.5 per million BTU for gas. So when we have this discussion quite often with utilities about what makes sense for them. And, right now gas, it sells pretty cheap, like $4 or even less in some markets. And so when we're looking out in the future, we're talking about these units producing power from 2023 and beyond. And so as we're dealing with utilities, that's the time frame they're looking at. They're trying to decide, one, what's their lowest cost, what are the environmental impacts that are going to drive their decision, what sort of diversity do they want out there. And as Jose mentioned, in our discussions, we are getting a lot of interest. We have over 20 utilities in the United States that participate in our New Skill Advisory Board looking at this for their integrated resource plans moving forward. We have one group, Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems out of Utah with members in Idaho, who are currently planning on building the first plant out in the area of the Idaho National Lab to serve their needs. And they're faced with the very problem I mentioned earlier, and that's the retirement of coal units.
Mm-hmm.
Paula.
So can you boil it down a little bit more and compare it with the cost of wind, solar, stuff that we have, if it were in place right now, what and maybe how soon you're talking about having it at a commercial scale, how we can compare that?
Chair Peterson, Representative Boone, you're looking for a price per kilowatt?
Yeah.
Want to broke down to that?
Yeah.
About 9 cents.
Yeah, basically we're talking, Chairman,
okay.
And mm-hmm. We're talking about 9 cents per kilowatt type of numbers right now.
And follow up. And how does, what's wind, what's solar, what's hydro now?
That's not that simple a question to answer. I would recommend that the dialogue that takes place talks about whether or not you're going to do new generation or not.
Mm-hmm.
We don't recommend that like hydro that's available today, you're not going to secure that in favor of creating a new power source. What you have to look at is at what point in the load growth do you need a new resource, mm-hmm. and what should that resource be? So you compare against the options at that time. So when we're looking forward, one of the reasons I pointed out that we don't see the load growth in hydro is because there's almost nothing that competes well with hydro. The fuel is free, and so those facilities have been typically capitalized quite a while ago, so it's an operating and maintenance kind of expense to keep them going. It's very favorable power, which is why Bonneville Power Administration relies so greatly on the fleet of hydro plants in the Northwest. But as you look forward and you say you need the next new megawatt, then you do look at solar and wind and typically right now natural gas and nuclear. And we believe that for a per kilowatt basis, our electricity will compare very favorably with wind and solar. But the catch is you have to take a look at your availability of power. So you need the power on basically whenever you flip the switch, you expect the lights to come on. So you have to look at the profile during the day, what sort of storage you have in the particular area that you're serving. Like if you have a lot of hydro storage, so you can deal with intermittent sources and on and on. So as we deal with the customers, it tends to be very unique to the application, the area they're in. The features that the small modular reactor brings is that ability to adjust very rapidly to the needs of an area if you are dealing with intermittent power sources such as wind and solar.
So final follow-up. So those of us up here know that I'm very much involved with wave and tidal power and wondered how does this technology figure in, since they're both fairly new.
Yeah.
And wave and tidal are coming in, a little bit more expensive than some of the stuff that's out there already. But how does this fit in there too? Is this like way high? Here's where we are now. Here's where wave is. Is this up here or is it here?
Okay. Well, Chairman Peterson, Representative Boone, quite frankly, I do not have the tidal power numbers. The exposure that I've had in the past to that would tell me that's fairly expensive power. But frankly, in defense of any new technology, you need to look ahead at what is, a mass application kind of number. I don't believe that exists right now in tidal power, so I'm highly confident any number you get out of that is likely to show up very expensive.
Representative Holtby.
Thank you, and I know you probably touched on this a little bit, and looking at you know, nuclear power and the stigma that we've got around nuclear power with, you know, the things that have happened in Japan and the problems that we have on the Columbia with Hanford leaking and those sorts of issues. And it looks like, you know, this design you have is purportedly safe, and so we're not really looking at, you know, potential, you know, meltdowns or anything like that. But I missed the part about spent fuel. Is there any spent fuel with this? And, you know, what's the proposition for storage of that so that, you know, to get past that stigma that we have of spent fuel being a huge environmental problem and being toxic and not really being able to store it indefinitely or for as long as it's a danger anyway. So
I'll take a shot at that one. Chairman Peterson, Representative Colby. I think that is exactly the dialogue that needs to take place when you have the type of discussion that's proposed here. The reality is that in this country right now, we do not have a licensed long-term repository for high-level waste. I know that some of the folks who are going to follow us are going to talk to that just a little bit, but I'll also offer, I do think that one of the things that the activity of the task force can do very well is help to learn what the risks are, what the current technology is, and how you handle that going forward. I would invite you, if you haven't seen what used nuclear fuel dry storage looks like, you know, take a look at it. I have been responsible for that, and what you actually do with it today, all the commercial nuclear plants, say they store it right now in a spent or used fuel pool. They allow it to cool for 5 years, and then they stick it in dry fuel storage casks. And those storage casks are they're surprisingly low tech. It's essentially a steel can that supports the assemblies, and then it's most commonly within a concrete liner, and they just air cool in the same way that Dr. Ray has talked about long-term cooling here. That's what happens there. So they're very low tech. They're very heavy. They tend to be about 300 tons. And if you take a trip out to Columbia Generating Station, you see 27 of them sitting there. And the reality is we need an effective national policy to deal with the future of used fuel. For the nuclear engineers in the crowd, many of them will know that the solutions of reprocessing and even using the fuel in what's called fast reactors is a technically viable option out there. It's the recycling of fuel is more commonly used in the rest of the world. It's not done in the United States, but it is done elsewhere. And I think the technical crowd would suggest we engage in that and likely interim storage until such time that we're ready to engage in that piece of it. But that is the dialogue. I think, you know, what Dr. Reyes has done here is take, in my opinion, the safety issue kind of off the table, and we do end up at cost and waste stream issues, which I think is the appropriate place to have the dialogue. And that is the effective dialogue that I think takes place when you engage in the testimony of a task force. So it's not an easy answer. I don't have a quick answer for you. If I did, I'd probably be off solving world hunger, but that's all I can do.
Madam Chair, and Representative Colby, testimony that's coming after us is going to be discussing some of those options. Everything is well moved, what to do with some of the spent fuel and how to handle it. So that will be coming to you soon.
Thank you for being here. Very interesting topic. One of my questions was answered already, and I think I heard that you would be on the market in 2022-ish. Could you tell me a little bit about what your phases of development are and what phase you are in that development? I'm just trying to get a feel for how real is this, are these products?
All right, Chairman Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon. NuScale Power is essentially owned by Fluor. Fluor is a engineer, procure, construct company with very deep pockets, and they have invested over $270 million in our program so far, our company. And we're at the point now where we are in discussions with the NRC and on the technical points of design certification. We've presented many topics to them, over 40 different presentations to the NRC, and are on schedule to deliver to them the application for the design certification at the end of next year. That leads, that's about a 40-month review process that then leads to the called the safety-related construction part of a new site. And the first site right now planned is the site in Idaho for the Utah Associated Municipal Power System. So the realness of it, as Dr. Reyes said, over 600 people working on it, well over $250 million spent working on this design. We are on schedule to submit with the NRC next year, and we have a very active engagement from, as I said, over 20 utilities in the United States. And I can tell you, people are knocking on his door all the time from around the globe looking for this to be available to them as a commercial one.
Do you have functional prototypes and so forth? And if so, what stage are they in?
You want to take that?
Yeah. Madam Chairman, Representative Reardon, we have very extensive test programs. And in fact, I just got back from one test program that we have in Italy, which is a full-scale steam generator. So our design incorporates a very compact helical coil steam generator to produce superheated steam for our turbines. So it's a novel concept for nuclear, although it's been used a lot in other industries. We built a full-scale version of that so we can test it at the proper prototypic flows, temperatures, and pressures. We also have the integral test facility, which models the reactor, the containment, and the pool that I showed you earlier in the photograph, which is at Oregon State University. That's a 1/3 scale working version. It's non-nuclear. We're using electrical heaters to simulate the nuclear core, but we're testing all the safety systems in an integrated fashion with that facility. We've also got test facilities for our fuel in Canada, and we've just recently built a new fuel bundle for our reactor design in Richland, Washington. So test programs, all those programs are required so that we can validate our computer codes, and all that information gets gathered and presented to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as part of that application that my colleague just mentioned. So that's part of the safety assessment that the NRC will review. They'll look at all of our data. Every time we perform a test in a new test facility, the NRC will physically send inspectors. They watch us perform the test. They review the data. And that's all that evidence gathering is what's happening right now as part of our pre-application with the NRC.
Great. Interesting.
Thank you.
And if I may, Chair Peterson, Rep. Reardon, part of the reason I did this, first time I went down and met with Dr. Reyes, he was still at Oregon State at the time, and they were just starting up in a small building, and they had the first reactor there. And I just saw how things were changing. I'm sitting here wondering, we have this in Oregon. It's happening right here at Oregon State, yet we can't do anything in Oregon. We're having to ship this technology out. And here we have our brightest minds down there working on this, and they can't practice right here at home. And to me, that was wrong, and that's why I've been pushing this as hard as I have. And now they're employing 600 people, and they were probably 30 people when I was down there then. I mean, they were just getting off the ground, and a lot of it was done with the students at Oregon State at the time. So,
that's the same question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reyes, thanks so much for being here. Would this, the facility you've got a picture of up here, I think, is a 12-modular facility. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Would this technology have the capacity to be smaller than that so the energy could be regionalized, i.e. getting it closer to the consumers and eliminating some of the transmission issues that we might have and so forth? Is that possible for a city or for a part of the state or states?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct. We've looked at different configurations for this design, and it all winds up being economics. Mm-hmm. So depending on what part of the world and how much money you're spending for electricity, a 4-module or 3-module, 1-module even becomes economic. We've had requests from Guam, for example. They're paying outrageous amounts of money for because they're using diesel fuel for their power. This certainly one or two module plant there would make a lot of sense, much less expensive. So it depends on where it would be deployed, but it's technically it's quite possible.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
And you got your start in this field at OSU or spent a lot of time there, certainly. And I guess as we talk about the state investing in research and development in the idea of trying to reduce carbon output and so forth, what thoughts might you have about the state's investment and return on that investment for putting in, you know, you were at OSU, we also obviously also have other flagship universities too with some very smart people. Could you have thoughts about what we could do differently or we could do better perhaps than we currently are in terms of being a leader in how we can develop some of these clean technologies?
Yeah, Representative Johnson, it's a great question. Because I look at my own career and my career path, and I started my career with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, worked almost 10 years, and so mine was a mindset of safety from the beginning. When I came to Oregon State University, a lot of opportunities to be creative, to apply the things that we've learned to grow, and I started this project, which I fully expect that this will be a multi-billion-dollar company. I started this project with a $4,000 grant from OSU. Okay. So it just takes a good idea, a lot of dedication, and an opportunity. Someone at a university who would recognize that, you know, this is something different. We need to encourage this. In a lot of ways, I came to Oregon State University not as a professor, but in some ways as a student, because we were trying to build a program and trying to work together to innovate something new. Now, it took a long time. The life cycle of a project like this is about 20 years. And by the time we're done, we'll have spent about $1 billion moving this technology from the laboratory at Oregon State University to the market. So when you think about investment that can be brought to bear on clean energy issues, part of it is there's a lot of good ideas in the labs right now. If you visit Oregon State and you go to the different labs, you'll see some amazing things. It's getting it from the lab to the market that's the challenge. And so anything that can be done in terms of investment in that gap would be huge, because quite often it doesn't take a lot to get it there. It takes a lot of dedication, but getting through that gap is a challenge. So anything that can be done in that investment area would be fantastic.
Thank you.
Chairman Peterson, if
yes.
I may. I think Dr. Reyes is perhaps a bit too modest in how we got here. I just want to point out that Harvard Business School came to see us last year and interviewed he, myself, several others, and ended up writing a business school case on it, which is fascinating if you go read it. But what it gives you is this path that how from a really solid initial idea, it gets to this point of having what is now the largest spinoff business that Oregon State University has had to date. And so the reality is that from that modest $4,000 they received, we have received from the Department of Energy an award for $217 million in matching monies to help us get this design to the market. So it's fascinating to read. It'll make a great movie someday. Yeah. I invite you to take a look at it.
Thank you. And I think if it does become a multi-billion-dollar company, you probably have a engineering building with your name on it in the majority of OSU's campus.
No, right.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Professor.
So thank you. Sorry, I didn't raise my hand quite as quickly as I should have. So the two of you would be in the very best position to share with us the biggest challenge to selling the concept that you've come up with. And I'm sure there's three or four of them, but as you're, I think before the Fukushima disaster, there was great enthusiasm for nuclear. And then when that happened, everything kind of slowed down. That was a safety-driven issue. And we talked earlier or heard earlier about the cost of power issue. We heard about the storage issue. Which is it? Is it a combination of all of them as you go around and do your best to sell this kind of idea? What's the one at the very top? I was just looking at Southern Company's challenges with the Vogtle plant and what are they, $8 billion into God knows how much. I know it's a big, huge plant, not what you guys have in mind. But could you align for us the biggest challenge? What's keeping us from utilizing this power?
Madam Chairman, Representative Benz. It was interesting because when I started the company in 2007 with Paul Lorenzini, we were marching on a path, and then Fukushima occurred, and my concern was, well, there goes, you know, who's going to invest in a nuclear company now? And what happened was the exact opposite. The phone started ringing off the hook. We had folks, members of Congress, contacting us and saying, "You told us a little bit about this passively safe design. What's different about that?" Fluor invested in NuScale after Fukushima. And so that's very telling, because they saw that we had something different in terms of safety, that we had a real product that could be offered that resolved all those issues that were of major concern. So I think in terms of safety, once we have an opportunity to present the design and explain to them what's different about it, that opens up the door. Then the next questions that we see, typically it starts with discussions on safety. The next questions that come in are on economics. So how much does it cost? How will it compete with natural gas? And then you have companies like UAMPS, which say, well, natural gas at the hub, the price of natural gas at the hub is one thing, but I need to know the price of natural gas at the burner tip. How am I going to transport that gas all the way to where I need it in Idaho? So that's a different cost. And so when you start factoring those costs at the burner tip and you compare it to an opportunity to build a clean source of energy with employees that stay in the state, and potentially manufacturing in that state, the economics start to look extremely good. The second question is always the economics. Then, of course, for us, because we're commercializing this product, for us, we're always looking at building on our strategic partnerships. So Fluor is a strategic partner. They have a long-term view. They'll make money when they build the plants. But there's other strategic partners that we're trying to align with right now, manufacturing being a big one. And I'll tell you one thing, whoever lines up with us for manufacturing is in for a big win. So manufacturing, it's building those strategic partnerships that will help you deliver the product in the long term. So I think that's kind of the sequence that I've seen happening, and perhaps Dale.
I'll offer in addition to that, I think, you know, I mentioned earlier when we were talking about the price of electricity by resource, it really depends on what you're talking about in the world. So whereas right now in this country, if you're a utility competing in a market that is, let's say, an unregulated market, then you're competing against the price of gas today. And that's a difficult thing to compete with today. What we see is that, you know, in regulated markets or in areas where the gas is either not available because there's just not a pipeline or the volume there, or the other common situation is gas is very expensive, which is basically the rest of the world. So the rest of the world doesn't have the kind of cheap natural gas we have. So there, you know, there's a great interest in it. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, and I know Dr. Reyes mentioned Guam, but there have been so many nation states and others that have contacted us, seeing this as a solution for a difficult situation they find themselves in. I really think the biggest challenge is just completing the certification process in the United States. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is the gold standard in the world for nuclear design certification. Getting through that will open the doors for application both domestically and internationally very quickly.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you all very much for being here today, and Representative Widener for bringing this forward. So I don't believe Professor Woods is here today, so I'm going to call up Sam Goodrich, Thomas Riley, Jordan Cox. Can we get one more chair, and then we can have Kirsten mm-hmm. Fox come up as well, please. Hi, welcome. Please go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, representatives, thank you. Thank you for having this hearing on House Bill 3445. My name is Sam Goodrich. I'm currently pursuing a PhD in nuclear engineering at Oregon State University, and more importantly, I'm an Oregonian. So the sources of energy we use to power our lives are diverse, but they can be subdivided into two groups, those that derive from the sun ultimately and those that don't. Those that burning millions of years of stored carbonaceous energy from the sun over a handful of decades is resulting in global consequences. Carbon dioxide has been singled out as the primary threat associated with fossil fuel consumption, though there are many negative externalities such as decreased air quality and pollution. Geothermal, tidal energy, and nuclear are other forms of energy that ultimately don't derive from the sun, but only nuclear of these has been shown to scale up to our thirsty energy needs. Nuclear energy derives from the reaction to the level of the atomic nucleus, whereas combustion only scratches the atomic surface by rearranging a few electrons of the outer shell of an atom. The difference accounts for a staggering discrepancy in energy density. One molecule of methane combusting releases approximately 9 electron volts of energy, whereas splitting the nucleus of one atom of uranium results in the release of 200 million electron volts of energy. This is a multiplication factor of about 20 million. In 2014, the state of Oregon derived approximately 59% of our electricity from hydropower, 21% from natural gas, 13% from wind, and 5% from coal. While this energy mix is one of the more respectable in the union as far with respect to renewables, 26% of our electricity is still derived from fossil fuel combustion. This energy from fossil fuels amounts to about 1.8 gigawatts. Which, if we translate that into mass of CO2, it's about 10 million metric tons of carbon dioxide every single year created in Oregon, generating our electricity. That's about twice the mass of the Hoover Dam. In Oregon, there are approximately 2 million passenger vehicles, and they only emit 9 million tons a year, which is a significant amount, but it's less. You could take every single car off the road, passenger vehicle off the road, and it would have less of an impact than installing one large nuclear power plant in Oregon. If CO2 reduction is a goal that Oregon voters care for, then the metaphorical low-hanging fruit is, in this case, replacing fossil fuels with an alternative source of energy that doesn't produce CO2. The gentleman from NuScale mentioned capacity factor, which is essentially the amount of power a reactor puts out divided. It's a percentage based on the amount it possibly could. It's nameplate capacity. For nuclear, these days, it's up to the mid-90%. A few other options as carbon-free energy solutions for Oregon. Photoelectric solar power is about 12.7% capacity factor, and wind is at about 37%. So this means, for example, if we were to build out nuclear to replace this fossil fuel for our electricity demands, the capital cost, according to EIA, would be about $11 billion. Whereas because of this capacity factor, even though wind and solar are less than nuclear, they would be much more total in capital cost because you'd have to build out so much more of the source in order to maintain the same level of power. For solar, it would be about $55 billion, and for wind, it would be about $11 billion. But as they also mentioned, if you get too much of a fickle power source on the grid, it can destabilize the grid. And as we know in Oregon, the weather forecast should come with a question mark sometimes. So that you would probably need to build in some battery backup, and if you did about 12 hours worth of backup, it would be an additional $5 billion to a solar and wind build out. So in summary on that note, $11 billion for nuclear, about $60 billion for solar, and about $16 billion for wind if you were to replace the fossil fuels in our electricity mix. In addition to capital costs, there's a land cost as well. For this 1.8 gigawatts of electricity, a nuclear plant would take up about 0.2 square miles, whereas solar and wind would take up about 860 and 521, respectively, for square miles, respectively. For scale, Representative Johnson's district is about 800, 900 square miles, so we could pave your entire district with solar panels. The
Representative Bence has been asking for that.
So we went. Hydropower has been discussed. Essentially, we may have installed too many dams already as it is in Oregon, but there are some sources in the documentation you should have as to why that may be. Conservation and energy efficiency, while extremely important, are not by themselves a solution to the energy problem, because in order to conserve energy, there needs to be energy to conserve. Additionally, energy usage per capita is strongly correlated with quality of life, and Oregon's energy usage is well below the threshold at which the highest quality of life with current technology can be achieved, thinking of hospitals, lights, communication, education, food, quality, and hygiene. Every energy source has advantages and drawbacks. There's no silver bullet to providing Oregon with the energy it needs to keep our economy thriving. But if an intellectually honest and reasoned approach is taken, certain options will differentiate themselves as being more advantageous than others. Extracting millions of years of stored carbon from the ground and releasing it into the environment has real global consequences. And the first step for Oregon to take toward a solution is to open a dialogue about the possible reintroduction of nuclear power into the state. Being a nuclear engineer, people often ask me whether I think nuclear power has a future. And I often tell them the same thing, that I think if we want to maintain our lifestyle and be good stewards of the environment, sooner or later we will work our way back to nuclear power as an energy source for our society. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Jordan Cox. I am a second year master's student at Oregon State University, and I'm hoping to obtain my PhD in nuclear engineering. I will also briefly confess that this is a very nervous environment for me, so I will try not to trip over my words. I would also like to inform the council members that I am, in fact, directly paid to conduct research to advance the goals of nuclear energy by the United States Department of Energy. It is entirely possible, therefore, that I am, quote, a death industry payee to promote the end of human existence. Just wanted to throw that out there. However, before you believe that, I would like to explain to you my position on nuclear energy, particularly in regards to the current proposed bill, HB 3445. So I began my nuclear my mechanical engineering career at Utah State University. While attending, I had the opportunity to participate in Engineers Without Borders, an organization working to provide engineering expertise to the developing world. While working in the town of Tuna Grande, Peru, our team examined all sources of water. In the center of the town, there was a well with approximately 10 to 15 electrical cords coming out of it. Those cords powered submerged pumps that bring water out of the well, bringing clean drinking water to the community. Over and over again throughout my experience as an engineer, I have found that often access to basic human needs, including clean drinking water, medical care, and disease-free food, is heavily dependent upon reliable energy sources. I decided that I wanted to focus my graduate work in energy generation, and I began looking at different energy sources I could be involved in engineering. In looking, I found that I made a discovery, and I would like to share that with you, a discovery with you. This is the discovery. Quote, proponents of certain power sources, either for political or fiscal reasons, would like everyone to believe that today's energy crisis has simple solutions. Quite simply, this is not true. The United States power grid is perhaps the most complex system mankind has ever built, delivering instant and consistent power across the country without any significant form of storage. That's amazing. To keep the system running, as our energy demands grow, will require a diverse energy production portfolio. To emphasize the necessity of diversity, I would like to point out a few flaws of several energy sources, nuclear included. The three sources I've chosen, for lack of time, include hydroelectric, solar, and nuclear. Hydroelectric is a particular favorite of the Pacific Northwest, generating 68% of our electricity, of our energy. However, hydroelectric has significant watershed impacts and is limited by natural resources and therefore has an upper generating limit. Solar energy, often touted as the solution to all energy problems, has downsides as well. The efficiency of solar panels is very low. Solar panels are produced using very damaging and caustic chemicals using current processes. The most effective time of day for solar panels, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., is only 25% of the day. This means that even if significant power storage were available, currently it is not, you would require four times as many solar generation plants as other equivalent units. These plants would cause massive spikes in energy during the day and generate no electricity at night, causing great stress on your electrical grid. Nuclear energy has its own technical difficulties. Foremost among them in the United States is the lack of long-term fuel repository. Besides the spent fuel concern in this country, any nuclear plant will have public opposition and require significant capital investment by the energy company. My goal in sharing some of the current challenges is not to discourage, but rather expose that there is not any panacea to the current energy crisis, but rather the future will likely require our states adopting a broad range of power generation technologies. In regard specifically to the proposed bill HB 3445, I strongly encourage the Oregon State Legislature to consider or to adopt citizens seeing as I was dead, the bill for three reasons. Firstly, because the establishment of this bill in no way suggests that the state of Oregon must pursue nuclear power, but rather aims to provide the legislators with sufficient information to make an informed decision on the future of nuclear energy in Oregon by allowing the task force to conduct research amongst its nine members. Second, this task force, in my understanding of the bill, will not cost money, as cited that members of the task force who are not members of the Legislative Assembly are not entitled to compensation on line 13 and 14 of page 2. If costs are incurred, they will likely go directly to creating jobs by providing staff to the task force, or will encourage federal income to the state as the task force discovers areas of research that could be used to create undergraduate or graduate research positions, which I am in favor of. Finally, nuclear task forces have been successfully established in other states and have produced valuable data for their decision-making processes. I appear to be over my time?
No, you're good.
Okay. Well, then I would like to add...
We have another bill, so we need to wrap up.
Okay, thank you. I would like to add two additional points for emphasis. In reading opinions against this bill, I understood that several testifiers believe that today's energy crisis could be solved by conservation. While conservation plays an important role, I would invite every council member to examine a small device that I am fairly certain each of you has in your pocket, the smartphone. 10 years ago, this device category did not exist. I would ask, how much energy do you think this device consumes? Just so each council member is aware, between the cell phone towers, file transfer services, and search engines that wirelessly deliver content to your cell phone device, over its lifetime consumes roughly the same energy as two refrigerators in your home. While conservation has been underway, I would like to emphasize that the developed world does not reduce its power consumption. Rather, we continue to invent new ways to use power. Second, I would like to reiterate my devotion to the environment. Many people have rightly mentioned that there is an issue with spent nuclear fuel. I strongly believe that the federal government needs to provide avenues to dealing with spent nuclear fuel. However, the task force proposing this bill is interested in examining these methods. Not forming this task force would suppose that solutions to spent fuel do not exist, which is not true. Engineers are working tirelessly to provide solutions, and we will succeed if given the opportunity. This summer, I am working at Argonne National Labs that has massive programs on developing solutions to spent nuclear fuels. Again, I am strongly in favor of the proposed bill for reasons stated, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Representative Wagner,
I could just one quick question. You could touch on a little bit the fast burn reactors and stuff and how you can reuse the fuel in the system.
Sure.
Before we finish up.
So I actually consult for a company called TerraPower. It's in Washington. They are their main reactor design is a fast reactor, which doesn't use water essentially to slow down neutrons. And in these fast reactors, they are able to generate more fuel than they burn, which is called a breeder reactor in this case. There are a few different advantages to a fast reactor for the fuel cycle. One, initially, is the fact that you may leave the fuel in the reactor for 30 years without changing it out every few years, which significantly reduces the total volume of nuclear fuel that you need to deal with. But in addition, fast reactors can be used to burn a lot of so-called waste from the current third generation of reactors to generate power. And in addition, they obviate the necessity for enrichment by generating their own fuel, which can then be enough to jumpstart another reactor or even two at a time until you have generations of reactors that weren't initially started up with enriched fuel, if that makes sense. Essentially, fast reactors can reduce... I'm sorry, I didn't say Madam Chair before I responded. But fast reactors can reduce the total amount of fuel waste significantly.
Thank you very much.
Can
it be very quick?
It'll be quick. Yeah. I just wanted to say that this is the timing frame in the legislative session where we're looking at budgets, and higher ed's always, you know, right up there, too. And we see your professor back there looking like a proud daddy. And I guess I would close with, I was all ready to go back to grad school, and then I see somebody like you come up before me, and I think the competition is way out of my league, above my pay grade.
Thank you both very much for being here today and for all your work on this.
Thank you.
So we're going to next call up Lloyd Marbot, Charles Johnson, Miriam Gierman, and Nancy Newell. And I only see three people, so if Linda Richards is here, she can also come.
been a while.
Just one minute. I can stand on that.
There's four. There's a
yeah.
There's
four chairs.
Sit there. Okay.
All right.
Does Nancy not?
Just like deja vu.
Please go ahead when you're ready.
Madam Chairperson, I'm a little under the weather, and I apologize for appearing in front of you in that condition, but I felt that it was important to be here today to discuss the ramifications of House Bill 3445. I appear before you today in opposition of that bill.
Can you please introduce your say your name for the record?
Sure. My name is Lloyd Marbette, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Conservancy Foundation. And I appear before you today in opposition to House Bill 3445. This bill creates at taxpayer expense an official cheerleading squad advocating the use of nuclear power in Oregon. It does so in a clever way. It creates a 9-member task force that shall study and report on methods to procure nuclear energy, along with an analysis of the costs and benefits of using it for Oregon's energy needs. Regardless of the results of this analysis, the task force is then mandated to, quote, recommend a strategy for the contribution of nuclear power to inexpensive, environmentally sound energy for this state, unquote. This is pure cheerleading, regardless of the weight or adequacy of evidence, and in addition, we are asked to ignore the actual performance of this technology thus far. Its never-ending cost overruns and ongoing nuclear accidents, which are not inexpensive nor environmentally sound. Its continuing failure to permanently dispose of commercial high-level nuclear waste. All of the Trojan nuclear plant's high-level radioactive waste is in 34 dry casks stored on a concrete pad above the Columbia River. It awaits a nuclear garbage man to come and take its waste to a permanent repository that's yet to exist. You would think that the proponents would first demonstrate the successful cleanup of existing waste before advocating more be produced. The proposed task force is also not unbiased. It consists of 9 members. 4 of those members are from the nuclear and/or electric power industries, and the 5th is from Oregon State University, which is actively testing and promoting reactor designs, including NuScale's modular nuclear reactor under licensing review by the NRC. The task force sets its own rules, and it's authorized to recommend legislation. There is no limit on how much money it spends or how it will affect the workload of other state agencies. In order for the task force to create its strategy for the contribution of nuclear power in Oregon, it will have to recommend repealing the law passed by voters requiring a federally licensed waste repository and a vote of the people before a commercial nuclear plant can be licensed in this state. If the legislature truly wants an unbiased report on the costs and benefits of nuclear power, then I suggest appointing an unbiased hearing officer to hold a contested case proceeding. Allow both pro-nuclear and anti-nuclear parties to intervene with the power to present evidence, conduct cross-examination, and provide a final analysis of the record. It'll be far cheaper than what's before you right now. But I know from experience that the nuclear industry will seek to avoid that kind of transparency. And it would be far better for this legislature to fully embrace conservation and renewable energy, which is fast leaving nuclear power and fossil fuels in its cost-effective dust. And I footnoted a book which has just been published by Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. I invite you to read this book. It's very readable, and it's full of factual information showing, just in fact, how renewable energy and conservation is leaving nuclear power and fossil fuels in its dust. I educate yourselves. Please do not burden Oregon taxpayers anymore with this technology. If they've got the phone over-ringing all the time, which sounds wonderful, let the free market pay for it, not Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Chuck Johnson. Excuse me. Is this working?
Yeah, and you don't have to be so close.
Ah,
you can,
okay,
yeah, you can
it
do
works.
Like 6 to 8 inches.
I'm Chuck Johnson. I'm the director of the Joint Task Force on Nuclear Power for the Oregon and Washington chapters of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I'd like to present the testimony of one of our advisory board members, Dr. John Howison. I'm just going to read it into the record right now.
Do we have a copy of that?
You do. I'm going to read it anyway.
If you have a copy, it's already in the record. It's already a part
okay.
of the record.
Okay. Then.
But we'd love to hear your thoughts on that. If,
all right.
Since you're here in
that's
person.
Fine. My main thought in this, and echoing Dr. Howison's testimony, is that this is. This seems to be putting the cart before the horse. The Oregon voters were quite clear in 1980 that until any more nuclear plants can be built in the state of Oregon, there needs to be a high-level radioactive waste repository established by the federal government, licensed to operate, and that repository needs to be open, and then the voter, at that point, the licensing process would refer that question to the voters of Oregon on it for a yes or no vote. At this point, this federal repository has been something that's been promised consistently over the years and not delivered on, and there's no end in sight. The Yucca Mountain site was forced upon Nevada back in 1987 by the federal government. There were three sites left. One was Hanford, one was Yucca Mountain, and the other was in the panhandle of Texas. Yucca was less successful at fighting it off, but since that time they've proven to be quite adept at fighting that site off. And it is a terrible site. If people think that somehow we're going to put the waste in Yucca Mountain anytime soon, they are incorrect. The area has volcanic action, it has earthquake action, it has water migration through the site. They have had to try to change the criteria by which they site that facility, and were not successful in figuring out a way to store waste safely there for 10,000 years, let alone the 100,000 years it would take for the plutonium to break down. So people talk about the politics involved in stopping the Yucca Mountain site. There's been politics involved from day one with that site. There was politics that selected it. There's politics that's blocking it. But the science doesn't support it because it's very difficult to store this waste, and you should not be making decisions about where to store something this deadly based on whim and politics and a desire to move forward with nuclear energy. I want to refer you to what the statutes say about the type of waste that would be generated by a NuScale reactor. They define the type of waste that would have to have this repository as high-level radioactive waste means spent nuclear fuel or the radioactive byproducts from the reprocessing of spent nuclear fuel. Spent nuclear fuel means nuclear fuel rods or assemblies which have been irradiated in a power reactor and subsequently removed from that reactor. This NuScale reactor is a light water reactor. It is produces waste that is of the same type that was intended to be put in a repository, and therefore would violate state law to be built in the state. As to the question of whether or not the NuScale design is better, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology did a study in 2003 about what would be needed to get to create a nuclear power renaissance, and the four main issues that they felt needed to be dealt with for that to happen were to improve nuclear safety, to have a solution to the waste disposal problem, to address costs, and to deal with the question of nuclear proliferation, because fissionable materials can be made into nuclear weapons. On that score, NuScale is maybe in terms of safety. It's hard to say because they're submitting their design to the NRC in the fall of 2016. The Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Ed Lyman, has some very big concerns about this particular reactor, because what his main concern is that there are some inherent safety features in the reactor design, but in order to make this cost effective, they're talking about weakening other existing safety factors, such as the number of personnel that would be required for protecting the site, the evacuation zone around the site, and things like that. So the devil is in the details on safety. Okay. So that's an open question.
And I want to make sure that we have time to get to everybody because we have another bill to hear.
Well, I think other people had an opportunity to present the pro-nuclear side. I would like an opportunity to present our side.
And I just remind you, this bill is not moving out of this committee. I do want to make sure that the people who are up here who also have time to testify.
I want to talk about each of these 4 points, and it won't take me too much longer to do it. We've already talked about the waste issue. This is the same waste. It hasn't solved that. In terms of the cost, question is, the reason why reactors were built large in the first place was because of economies of scale. When you go to the expense of siting and building a nuclear power plant, you want to be able to get a lot of power out of it. The idea that you could build these small modular reactors and have them be cost-effective is just simply not the case. The only way that you could even approach cost-effectiveness is if you did a full build-out of a 6-pack or a 12-pack of these reactors. So at this point, there's a reason why reactors have been built bigger and bigger. The theory that somehow you can mass produce these reactors without having an error in the production line that would totally derail your project, or that somehow you would be able to sell enough of them to bring the price down and make it cost effective, does not, at this point, beyond Fluor Corporation, pass a smell test, and the U.S. government apparently as well. In terms of the proliferation issue, no, this is not addressed as well. There are countries around the world that are very interested in getting nuclear reactors. There's a lot of them. Some of them are our allies right now. Later on, they might not be. And this is a problem that we've had throughout the nuclear age. We sell reactors to other countries, and then later on, we become regretful. We had a reactor program going with the Shah of Iran at one time, and that program converted over to a Soviet program, and that's a reactor program we're trying to stop currently. So if you could build small reactors, perhaps the kilowatt hour would not be that attractive, but the fact that it could generate materials you could make into bombs might be extremely attractive to a small group or to a smaller country that could afford it. And then finally, we're talking about a reactor that at this point has not been built, not been proven, has yet to submit its design to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission so that people can evaluate it. It's not due to be submitted until the fall of 2016. The first plant, the prototype, will not be completed in Idaho until 2023, they're saying. So at this point, and it violates Oregon state law to build one, I'm just curious as to what would this task force be looking into, particularly a STAC task force, as Lloyd Marbet had pointed out earlier. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Mimi Gurman, and before I introduce who I work with, I'd like to make sure that all of the representatives on the side of the circle here are paying attention as much as they were when the other people were talking earlier today.
Could you please go ahead and read your...
I'm here today in strong opposition to HB 3445. My name is Mimi Gurman. I am co-founder of No Nukes Northwest and the creator of radcast.org and the West Coast Says No to Nukes Coalition. That's California, Oregon, and Washington. Stating that there will be no expenses for this bill is the first false statement you made among many others. Taxpayers are indeed already paying for your pro-nuclear, all-industry, nuclear tour de force as stated in HB 3445. HB3445, comprised of an all-star pro-nuclear cast of players who we've just heard from and who apparently was very entertaining to you. You decided to bring this insanity in the form of a bill to the table, and now we are paying for your time. Let's be clear. This is not a task force. HB3445, in your minds, is a surefire method to move nuclear power into Oregon. It starts with a member of OSU who deals with NuScale and small modular reactors and ends with a representative from NuScale that can procure nuclear energy. That's in your statement. In between are PUD commissioners and utilities, and more utilities, three times utilities. How dare you work for the nuclear industry while taking a paycheck from the environmentally conscious citizens of Oregon who have not asked you to do this, nor have you asked them if you may, and you may not. For whose interest would you repeal the people's decisions on ORS 469, 595, and 597 in order to bring SMRs to the Oregon market, the nuclear industries? How dare you bring this bill to the table? Is the Trojan nuclear waste not enough for you? Is the situation at Hanford not enough for you? Is a decrepit and failing Columbia Generating Station nuclear power plant in Washington, which does affect us across the river, not enough for you? More nuclear energy is not the answer. It is time to embrace honor and righteousness for the people who elected you and now who are educating you. We do not need more nukes. Small modular reactors are nuclear reactors, and remember that while the task force tells you how safe they are, how green, and how inexpensive. Harness what the rest of us in Oregon value. Conservation and renewable energy is the only way forward. Look up, witness the glorious sun, feel the wind in your hair, and abolish HB 3445 before it abolishes us. Thank you for listening. Oh, one more thing. I have an article that I've written in Counterpunch, which I will submit, which is called Why Fukushima Ended All Debate About Nuclear Power.
Thank you.
I'd also like to point out that I think the time differential between talking about the wonders of this new technology.
Can you please introduce your name?
I'm sorry. My name is Linda Richards, and I'd also like to make sure that my written testimony has been submitted.
It is, and we have that, and that's mostly what people are looking at up here.
Oh, really?
Yes. So you can, and just make sure you're like about 6 inches from the mic.
Is that good?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
I'll just share a few of the aspects that I've been researching. My name is Linda Richards, and I am a historian of science, and I have done my dissertation research at Oregon State University in the most amazing nuclear archives, but I've also traveled to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, as well as the UN and the World Health Organization in Geneva. And I've studied the creation of radiation health safety standards. I'd like to point out that the NRC is no gold standard for safety, that these radiation health safety standards were handed down to the NRC from the Atomic Energy Commission. They are the same standards that allowed nuclear weapons testing to occur, and that the Public Health Service cooperated with the Atomic Energy Commission to tell the public falsely that radiation was not dangerous for them in small amounts. This idea that under a natural background level of radiation, that radiation would not be dangerous comes from Willard Libby, who created this paradigm. And this paradigm has continued to this day, despite the fact that almost all geneticists since the 1940s and before, actually as early as the 1930s, insisted that there was no safe level of radiation. I spoke with the EPA about the planned weakening of their radiation health safety standards for the installation of small modular reactors, and I want everyone to be aware that when we are considering safety, safety will be on the table. And there's a lot to learn about this history. With all due respect to all the people who care about us being harmed by climate change, we have an abundance of alternatives that do not have the kind of dangers that radiation has. And if the NRC had earned our trust, That would be different. If the plants that they built had been safe, like we had been promised they would be, we would be having a different conversation today. But because those things and that trust was broken repeatedly over time, it is imperative that we go with resources that we can trust are less dangerous. And I will just end on that point. And one last final point is that there really has been no democratic process for gaining consent to having nuclear power risks or pollution. And I would like to say that I felt the format today reiterated that. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much for coming down to testify. As we have said several times, the bill is, this was more of an informational find out what was going on with the research with OSU, which was very fascinating. I think all of us are concerned about the impacts of climate change and the traditional sources of energy that we've been using and looking at a lot of different reasons for path forward. So I appreciate you being here today to talk about how you feel about this particular path. So thank you very much.
Oh,
Representative
Colby.
Oh, yeah. Do you have any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Colby, sorry.
Well, I would just like to note, when I was looking at the testimony of Ms. Richards, it appears that only one page of her testimony is on OLIS, so I'm not sure where the second page is.
Oh.
Because it kind of stops in mid
That's right.
sentence.
Oh, did you notice that?
So no, could we make sure it gets on?
We'll have Anastasia make sure that it's the whole
Thank
thing
you.
Is submitted. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
No. Okay, thank you all very much.
Very disappointing.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3445 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 4.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nancy Newell, I was told that I would have time. I had a problem. I had to go out here.
Oh, was your I called your name.
She was filling her cat her meter. Yeah.
Do you have written testimony that you submitted? I'm sorry, I've closed the public hearing.
I have not submitted.
Okay, so how about this? Let's do this because we have a bill that's up, and then we can bring you back at the end. And
do you know how long that will be?
I don't know, but we do have.
Well, I work with the governor of the state as well as the head of the Department of Energy of the state of Oregon, and they should have a statement here that's entered into this public hearing.
Because we're going to stand at ease.
$1 billion
stand at ease.
In alternative energy.
If your meeting hadn't gone so long,
Nancy. So we're going to call the meeting back to order, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 412. Beth, can you provide us with a description of this bill?
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 412 would declare for purposes of rules adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission under the solid waste statutes that require a determination that the use of solid waste is productive, that upland placement of dredge materials by a port district is productive. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. And first we're going to call up Ian Whitlick and Catherine Williams and Palmer Mason.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Palmer Mason with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I think what we've been asked to do on Senate Bill 412 is talk a little bit about what the bill does, provide some background to the committee. And in doing that, I have with me Tom Roik. He's a senior policy analyst at the department, and he's going to help me. In fact, Tom will start, and then I'll probably add a few remarks if that suits the committee.
Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee, my name is Tom Roik. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Senate Bill 412A determines that the upland placement of dredge materials by port districts is productive. So I'll provide some background to help explain why there's a need for upland use of dredge material to be productive, why it's important in the context of Senate Bill 412. Maintenance dredging projects within our ports are subject to compliance with the Clean Water Act, which ensures that dredging and any placement of sediments in water is protective of waters of the state. If sediments replaced upland, however, there are concerns beyond water quality. We need to address potential for impacts to people or wildlife in a terrestrial senate. In Oregon, our solid waste laws give us the ability, the authority, that is, give DEQ the authority to ensure that upland placement of sediments is protective of people and wildlife. Within our solid waste laws are a subset of rules for the beneficial use of solid waste. These rules, adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission in 2010, are modeled after other states that also have beneficial use of solid waste programs. The intent of these programs is to provide an opportunity for businesses that generate industrial solid waste to find uses for those wastes as an alternative to disposal in a permitted landfill. So beneficial use of industrial waste is it's analogous to recycling of cans or glass bottles. It can save valuable resources and divert materials from our landfills. At the same time, we have examples where individuals or businesses have stockpiled waste with the hope of or intent of finding a use for that waste without really knowing what the use is. And the term for that is speculative accumulation. So one example is the stockpiling of waste tires, which historically has caused a lot of safety concerns. Another example is the stockpiling of slag or spent foundry sand from the steel industry. Again, without having an identified actual use, and those stockpiled materials can pose health and environmental hazards. For these reasons, the beneficial use of solid waste rules include a provision that the use must be productive, which includes that the use be reasonably likely and not speculative for it to be approved by DEQ. So the basis for this requirement in our rules is that a part of applying for a beneficial use determination from DEQ, which would include upland placement of dredge sediments, has to demonstrate that the use is actually productive. In the case of dredge materials, dredge sediments are commonly and have historically been used as fill material for construction projects. In fact, large areas of downtown Portland, as an example, are built on dredge sediments. Nevertheless, with the production of synthetic chemicals in the 1950s, such as PCBs and DDT, we now have a legacy of pollution that shows up in our river sediments. And so we do need to ensure that upland uses of dredge sediments are protective of people and wildlife. The beneficial use of solid waste rules have three criteria. The first is that the material must be characterized, that is, so we know what the material is, and if there are contaminants present, what the concentrations are of those contaminants. Secondly, that the use be productive, as I described earlier, so that we know what they're actually going to do with the material. And third, that the use will not cause an impact to public safety or the environment. So Senate Bill 412A, if passed by the legislature, will determine that upland placement of dredge materials by a port district is productive. Future port applicants will still have to characterize the sediments, and they'll still have to show that the upland placement will not have an adverse impact. But they will no longer have to show on a case-by-case basis that that use is actually productive. Additionally, DEQ will continue the same process for applications of a beneficial use of dredge materials by a port district. So that process includes DEQ review, demonstration that the placement is compatible with local land use regulations, and published notice and an opportunity to comment on an application for a beneficial use. DEQ is most concerned with ensuring that upland placement of dredge sediments will not cause an adverse impact, and that criteria will still apply if the legislature chooses to pass Senate Bill 412A. So I'll stop there. I'd be welcome to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you.
And if I might just add, for the sake of being brief and concise, the department is not supporting the bill. But the bill as amended is a bill that we worked with the Port of Portland and the other ports on, and so it's language that we can live with. So just so that's on the record.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Williams. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, 7200 Northeast Airport Way, Portland 97218. I'm going to, in interest of time, turn the majority of the port's comments in support of Senate Bill 412 over to Ian Whitlock, our Assistant General Counsel. I'm in the building most days, so we can talk to each other, and just because Ian's here today, I'm going to give him my time and my seat.
No, don't.
Are you sure? Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. I also will be very brief. Ian Whitlock, Assistant General Counsel at the Port of Portland, same address. Thank you very much, Tom, for the introduction. I don't really have much more to say. I think that's a good context for the bill. I just want to make clear that in this bill, the ports are not proposing any exemption from the environmental criteria that apply in the instances when material is placed upland. In fact, we're not seeking any exemption from the entire complex regulatory structure that applies to every dredging activity that a port district performs, which begins with an application to the Corps of Engineers and the Department of State Lands and proceeds along the administrative process that Tom described is only sort of the very end of a very long and complex process whose purpose is in large part to protect human health and the environment. We're not seeking to change that. Tom mentioned the issue of speculative accumulation that occurs with industrial waste. Port districts do sort of see themselves as different in that respect from the normal, from many other generators of what Tom described as industrial waste. If you notice the next time you're driving north on I-5 to Seattle, just after you've crossed the Cowlitz River, right near the confluence of the Cowlitz and the Tootle, you'll see a large berm of sand. That's material, I believe, that came out of the dredging activity that followed 35 years ago from the explosion of Mount St. Helens. To my knowledge, nobody has asked the entities that did the dredging in the days and weeks and months after that event what use they were going to put that material to. Does it have potential uses? It certainly does. It makes great construction fill, roadbed material. You can use it in any number of applications. But the problem for port districts is that when they do navigation dredging, that's not their first interest. Their first interest is to keep navigation channels and berths clear so that shipping can pass. And if they have a use for the material, which they frequently do, that's a good thing, but often they don't. And so the result is that they need to find a place to safely store that material, and sometimes indefinitely. So the bill would essentially answer the question posed by DEQ's rules as to whether that activity is in fact productive or not. It would answer that question, though, without limiting DEQ's ability to analyze the environmental consequences of any particular dredging activity. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Next, we are going to call up, I think it's Timmy Helzer, Alistair Roxburgh, Jeff Geisler, and Bob Sellinger. And sorry if I mispronounced any of those names.
It looks like it's pronounced Timmy, but it's really pronounced Tim.
Okay.
Tim Helzer, Portland, Oregon. Thank you very much for hosting us. I appreciate the opportunity, as do all of us. You have my written testimony before you. I've changed it a bit and would like to enter this into the record. Current DEQ requirements, as you've heard, for waste placement is three parts. First, productive use. Second, no adverse effect. Third, beneficial use. Loosely defined, productive use is something of value is to be done with it on that site. Second, no adverse effect. It won't hurt people or the environment. And third, beneficial use, it will enhance the community in some way. Second point, West Hayden Island is within 1,000 yards of where I live. It has 825 acres of high value, that's not our definition, that's Metro's definition, high value urban wildlife habitat, and it's also an area for juvenile fish along the Columbia River. It's less than a half a mile, this dredge dump site that the port proposes, is less than a half a mile from a major manufactured home community that's home to many health-challenged and handicapped residents. The consequence of dumping over the last 20 years without its being capped is that ambient dust blows off of this site and within the community of these health-challenged people. That makes them prisoners in their own homes to avoid that kind of contamination and toxic waste. Third, West Haden Island and this particular dredge spoil site is in the Columbia River floodplain. And as more and more waste gets dumped there, as a flood comes along, it simply raises the water level in other areas. So it creates more damage in other areas. The Port of Portland's history on this site is significant. For the last 20 years, it's dumped dredge spoils there of various levels of contamination and toxicity. It's all been allowed by the DEQ, subject to public testimony by residents, experts, city scientists. It has already dumped hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of toxic and contaminated materials there. It has been publicly reviewed. Even though the process is in place, it is weekly, W-E-A-K-L-Y, weekly administered. But nevertheless, it is a public process. Currently, the port has no plans, no productive use plans for this site on these 825 acres of West Haden Island. Since 1998, they have been proposing and developing plans for this site that would result in a marine terminal and manufacturing complex on West Haden Island. They proposed this to the City of Portland. City of Portland referred it to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. They took several years in studying this and receiving expert testimony and testimony from the general public, as well as from the Port of Portland. The Planning and Sustainability Commission developed a number of very wise mitigation requirements that said to the port, if you're going to build here, and maybe dumping dredge spoils is the first step in that process, this is what you're going to have to do. And they listed out in very specific terms what these mitigations were going to be. The port took about 6 months to review these, and on January 8th, 2013, they said, this is just way too expensive. We can't afford to build there. And they withdrew their proposal. In the last 2.5 years, the port has had no, quote-unquote, productive use planned for that site. Yet they've come to you and said, let us please bypass the productive use requirement in DEQ so that you could, you'll give this a blanket carte blanche to dump whatever we want there without having any kind of public review. What does that do to the citizens of that area? It says, get lost. You had your chance at review at the state legislature. Last, the port wants this bypass of DEQ regulations. It wants no more public review of productive use because they know they can't meet that requirement. They want a pass, a permanent pass from the Department of Environmental Quality so that they don't have to qualify for that because they can't. Last, we encourage you to defeat this Senate Bill 412. It does not work for the residents. It does not work for the environment. It does not work for the port. It certainly doesn't work for the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman and Committee, my name is Alistair Roxburgh. I'm a resident of Haden Island. Portland has rejected nuclear power, rejected the export from Portland of fossil fuels, namely coal and oil, and most recently propane. None of these activities have a place inside or close to our Portland metropolitan area. Portlanders have rejected dangerous energy shipments by rail, including transshipment of oil and coal through the Columbia Gorge and Portland to other rail destinations. And transshipment meaning we don't get any benefit whatsoever, just comes through. Although such transshipments on by rail still continue. So we must not allow another process, the dumping of dredge tailings inappropriately in our area. It's an established fact that our Willamette and Columbia rivers contain hundreds of dangerous toxins in their sediments, and to allow any organization a brand new and permanent carte blanche on dumping these sediments as dredged solid waste and defining that to be productive or beneficial or whatever is not in the public interest, nor is it in the public interest to artificially prop up the existing marine operations of the Port of Portland, which are notoriously unprofitable. Doing so would not only remove a major incentive to do better, but would unlevel the competitive playing field, which all real companies are subject to. It is therefore in the greatest public interest that I encourage you to defeat Senate Bill 412. What's more, the Port of Portland already, and historically on January 2013, abandoned plans for any development on West Hayden Island, saying that they could not afford the mitigation required by the city. And so they abandoned plans for developing and leave. They developed plans for development that leaves no productive use remaining for this site. For these reasons, and for the reasons stated by my colleague Tim Hauser, and many more, please defeat Senate Bill 412 as not only ill-conceived legislation threatening our valued neighbors on the island and around Portland and wildlife and their surrounding natural habitat. It is also another attempt by the Port of Portland to bypass critically important public review for their narrow purposes that do not serve the greater good of the general public. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify before you today. The current beneficial use policy under state law is a good law. The environmental group supported it because we want to see waste come out of landfills if it can be put into productive use. That makes sense. That's the whole principle has already been said behind recycling. But when the state adopted those rules, they put in three safeguards that were very important, and you've already heard those. One is that the use is productive, two, that it's been characterized, and three, that it's actually not going to cause environmental harm. Those are the kinds of things that give the community confidence that when we go outside of landfills and we allow people to put their waste somewhere else, it's actually going to be done in a way that protects the community and is productive. The productive use part of that test is important. It keeps entities from creating basically ad hoc waste dumps wherever they want with no future use for that waste that they're putting there. And dredge materials are waste. And as I've already been noted, the port has been putting contaminated wastes in a variety of places. Unfortunately, we missed this when it went through the Senate. That's on us. It did pass there, but that should not be taken as proof that it isn't controversial. It's extremely controversial. You'll be hearing from environmental groups. You'll be hearing from the public on this. I think you already are. When the port has tried to put their dredge materials in various locations, it's been met with real opposition. We've had standing room only hearings before DEQ. We've had lawsuits over this, and specifically over the placement of dredge materials, the issue that they seek to now have exempted from productive use. It's disappointing that the port has come down here to try and pass a law rather than addressing the public, which has, again, shown up time and time again to say, you're not doing this right. They've also said that to DEQ as well. Although it's a good law, it's been weakly enforced. We'd much prefer to see the Port of Port stick with the same system that everyone else, every single other producer of waste, has to follow. This is a special exception for the ports, and follow the public process. This is a way of bypassing that and weakening the existing law. So a couple of things that I just want to highlight in terms of what this really does. A, it gives ports a special exception from one-third of the protections that are out there for the community that no one else gets, special exceptions for ports. Two, it further weakens a well-intended law that has been enforced too weakly, in our opinion, already. This just makes it easier to bypass the protections that are already in place. Three, I think it undermines the confidence of the public in this law because DEQ is now going to automatically certify port dredge materials as productive no matter where they go and whether they're productive or not. It renders the word productive absolutely meaningless. The state's going to put its stamp on these dredge spoils and say, this is productive use. And the public's going to say, how so? Well, that's what the law says we have to say. It doesn't have any meaning. It's just the automatic stamp that we now give to their waste wherever they put it, wherever they want to put it. It still has to pass the other two parts of that test. I don't want to lose that. But this one piece now is rendered absolutely meaningless. It undermines the primary purpose of this law, which is to say if you're not going to put it in an established landfill, you got to demonstrate that there is a use that is productive and that it's reasonably certain to occur. It can't be speculative. That keeps ports and other entities from creating ad hoc waste dumps throughout our community. And finally, it does jeopardize our community. As you've already heard, they've put a lot of waste out there. It does blow around. It is partially contaminated. We just get these store piles of dredge materials here, there, and everywhere without consideration of the neighbors. And you know, I'm glad that DEQ can live with it, their term. They're not the ones that have to live with it. It's the neighbors, it's the communities that won't have the same kinds of protections tomorrow that they have today if this law is passed. So we would encourage you to defeat it. We think the port should have to follow the same laws as everybody else. They're there to protect us. And you know, we'd like to see ports, public entities, embracing environmental laws, not trying to bypass them. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair. Committee members, I'm Jeff Geisler. I'm the current chair for the Neighborhood Association on Hayden Island called High Noon. I concur with everything that they've said. The main thing that I don't think a lot of people realize is that when I started going to meetings about the Columbia River crossings, a lot of information came out from the Port of Portland. And one is that they have one place that they want to dump dredge spoils, and that's Hayden Island. They aren't even looking for any other place. And the other thing that you learn in these hearings is that when there's not a beneficial use described or there's not a construction plan for any type of development, the chemicals that are tested for is more like 70, 77. There's like 10,000 or 10 million chemicals. My neighbor here would probably have an answer for that. But they do not want to do anything except dump on Hayden Island. And, you know, the DEQ and all of the different Clean Water Acts, these have all been in process since 1889. And we still have the Superfund of the Willamette River. They're not identifying where the dredge material is going to come from, but they want to put it on our island. And, you know, for that reason and many other, I just can't imagine why we would let the fox, being DEQ, get in the hen house with the Port of Portland. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you all very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we have one more person who signed up to testify, Mark Landauer. Sorry. Come on down, Mark. If there's anybody else in the room who'd like to testify on this bill, you're welcome to come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association as well as the Columbia River Steam Shippers Association, and we're very supportive of Senate Bill 412. At the outset, I want to make it perfectly clear that dredging and dredge materials are and will remain highly regulated by the state and the federal government. Under this bill, the measure does not change that, nor will it change the standards for health, safety, and the environment. Dredging is conducted on an as-needed basis. 22 of our state's 23 public ports would benefit from this measure. Other local sponsors in the state include, of course, the International Port of Coos Bay, the Port of Garibaldi, the Port of Newport. I could go on and on. The notion that dredging is not productive is, in my view, patently incorrect. Public ports in Oregon are responsible for over 101,000 jobs, either direct, indirect, or induced, and generate more than $600 million in tax revenue at the state and local level. Many of our ports are the primary economic drivers in our communities, and with the federal disinvestment in core funding, our smaller ports are finding it increasingly challenging to keep their navigation channels and their marinas safe for both the maritime industry as well as the boating public. Making dredged materials a productive use, provided it is conducted by a public port, is a simple fix to a complex and difficult challenge, and the Columbia River Steamship operators, as well as the public ports, enthusiastically recommend the passage of this measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? No. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 236A. I will say that we're going to hold the public record open until Friday to give, I think there are a lot of people who are interested in submitting letters on this bill, and so we'll hold that open until Friday to give them a chance to do
Friday
that.
Friday 12 as well.
4-4. I'm sorry. Yep. Senate Bill 412. Yes, you're right. All right. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 412. And colleagues, we're going to carry over the work sessions that we had scheduled for today until Thursday. So we'll work on those bills on Thursday. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on the House Energy and Environment Committee. On the House Energy and Environment Committee. Close the public hearing.